Hey, it's no big deal. A few friends sitting down for a chat in Geneva. Everyone ante into the pot and let's see what Iran is willing to wager.
We don't think that these issues will be solved in one meeting. I don't think that we'll get the full perspective of Iran's willingness to engage in one meeting.
Well, the administration may be trying to keep expectations low, but let's not kid ourselves. As Iran and the U.S. sit down at the table today, the world will be watching the diplomatic game.
Stakes is high. You know them stakes is high. We talking about
the U.S. calls. Show us your nuclear cards, please, on The Takeaway.
Y'all know them stakes is high.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, October 1st. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry.
Good morning, Celeste. This hour, Saturn crashes into the sun.
What?
I'm serious. The quirky automaker is going to take a dive, we'll explain. And retiring in the middle of a financial meltdown, it's more like meeting the Grim Reaper. It's not about the golf. Louise Story has that story for us. And we'll look at Google's latest attempt, yes, at world domination. They're at it again.
Right now, let's talk to John Limbert. He's author of the new book, Negotiating with Iran, Wrestling the Ghosts of History. Limbert was a U.S. diplomat at the American Embassy in Tehran in 1979 and was actually held hostage there. He's also a historian of Iran. So, John, are the U.S. and Iran coming to talk about the same thing? Are they here for these talks for the same reason?
Well, Celeste, that's a great question. They certainly should be. The danger is, of course, is that they may not be. And when that happens, what you get is frustration because the other side appears to be immovable and obstinate and unreasonable. And then both sides come away from the table shaking their heads, saying, "Well, we tried, but the other side just won't listen." So then, where are we? We're back where we've been for 30 years.
Okay, John Limbert, stay with us. We're going to talk more about that in just a moment. But first, everything else you need to know this morning.
Well, in the headlines, the first round of those Iran nuke talks in Geneva is now over. It's not clear if more will happen later today. Rescue workers in western Indonesia are racing to save thousands trapped in broken buildings. Two quakes in as many days brought down hospitals, schools, and power lines. More than 500 are known dead, but the government believes the final death toll will be in the thousands.
Also in Asia, a police commander says it'll take weeks to account for all the missing after a tsunami hit American Samoa and nearby South Pacific Islands. The U.S. is moving in more aid workers and supplies. And GM says it'll stop making Saturns, as you mentioned, and close down dealerships. A deal to sell the brand to Roger Penske fell apart. The would-be buyer couldn't find a manufacturer for the cars.
So Wall Street dipped just a bit yesterday. The Dow opens at 97.12. The S&P starts trading at 10.57. The Nasdaq is going to begin at 21.22. And this hour, we're going to get two big indicators on how Americans are faring in the economy. We'll have the latest numbers on new jobless claims and bring you fresh figures on personal income and spending.
So there's some difficult talks that have been going on this morning in Geneva, and I bet, John, you, like me, have had to have difficult talks before, at least with your children, right? So how do you start that? You say, "Hey, what's up? How you feeling?"
It's been 30 difficult years. I'd really like to get something off my chest.
Sorry about those hostages.
Hostage thing bad, yeah. Sorry about shooting it on the plane in the 1980s. Yeah, they got a lot to talk about there.
Give us some advice. What would you do to start off these difficult negotiations? 8778-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. Good morning. The United States and five other world powers are in Geneva right now. They just finished the first session of high-stakes talks with Iran about their nuclear activities there, and they're going to meet a second time this afternoon in an 18th-century villa in Geneva, Switzerland. Meanwhile, the Iranian foreign minister has made a very quiet visit to Washington. It's the first time an Iranian of that rank has visited in a decade. These Geneva talks may be the most significant contact between the U.S. and Iran in 30 years or so. Joining us to talk about that, Mark Landler, diplomatic correspondent from our partner, The New York Times, is with us. So, Mark, the Obama administration seems to be keeping things on the down low, keeping expectations relatively minor, but the stakes are pretty high here, right?
The stakes are indeed very high, and the administration, I think, is trying to make the point that what we should probably watch for more than anything else is whether this meeting will be followed up by another one. If the Iranians come into the meeting and offer just enough to keep everyone willing to talk further, then there probably will be a follow-up meeting. It'll probably occur quite quickly, maybe even later this month. And at that meeting and subsequent meetings, you'd really start to see the two sides get into the heart of the matter, which is, you know, fully disclosing Iran's nuclear program, and then trying to develop ways for the international community to persuade Iran to accept much closer supervision to ensure that it remains a peaceful nuclear program, which, of course, is what the Iranians say it is, but which the West doesn't believe it is.
Okay, also joining us is John Limbert. He was a U.S. diplomat at the American Embassy in Tehran in 79. He was held hostage there for more than a year. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Celeste.
And George Lopez, author of a series of books on sanctions. He holds the Hesburgh Chair in Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame, and he serves as the Jennings Randolph Senior Fellow at the United States Institute of Peace, working on economic sanctions issues. So, John, let me ask you, this visit from the Iranian foreign minister, the first trip for an Iranian of that rank in about 10 years or so, is that a good sign?
The way it was billed, I think, was simply technical, that he wanted to look at the Iranian interest section here here in Washington. But of course, the way the relation has been over the past 30 years, it's going to be interpreted and reinterpreted. If it leads to something, if it leads to a reciprocal visit by somebody to Tehran, then it's interesting. But it could be like a lot of other things that have happened, where someone makes a gesture, something happens, and then it goes nowhere.
So we were talking earlier about whether or not the U.S. and Iran are really here to talk about the same things. Obviously, the U.S. and the other countries that are meeting with them want to talk about nuclear power and nuclear weapons, but Iran has said that's not what they want to talk about, correct?
That's exactly right.
So what does Iran want to talk about?
Well, what you risk here, of course, is what I call asymmetric negotiations. That is, where both sides come to the table and each ends up talking about different things. Iran has a whole series of concerns, but the underlying one is to revise or revisit its whole relationship, and it sees its relations with the West and with the U.S. in particular as being unequal, and comes to the table with a huge grievance, real or perceived, that the U.S. aim is not to reach some agreement between equals, but to humiliate it and to eventually to overturn the Islamic Republic and the government in Tehran.
So obviously we've been talking a lot about, hearing a lot about sanctions from the Obama administration. Here's what Secretary of State Hillary Clinton had to say on CBS's Face the Nation.
If we don't get the answers that we are expecting and the changes in behavior that we're looking for, then we will work with our partners to move toward sanctions.
So, George Lopez, you're an expert in sanctions. Do we have any idea what kind of sanctions they're considering against Iran?
Well, I think we certainly do, but I think we need to keep in mind that sanctions are a tool that serve a larger policy. So in that sense, I agree with my two colleagues who have already spoken that the real goal here in the policy in the short term is to keep talking and have the next meeting and the next meeting. And even if the Iranians do a lot of venting in this meeting and not focus in on the issues, if the Obama administration has the sanctions in their back pocket and the threat of sanctions, they increase on the Iranians the costs of not getting down to business in the next meeting and the next meeting. So you have a couple of things going on at once, I think. One is the interesting irony that after all these years of the Iranians screaming that the United States doesn't want to come to the table, now the United States has come to the table with both a fig leaf in the one hand and potential sanctions in the other, and it says to the Iranians, we're here, now it's your turn to talk, and the Iranians seem a little caught off guard or need to do a little muscle flexing in order to establish their place at the table. Secondly, it seems that having fessed up to the IAEA about a secret facility, the Americans don't have to demand the whole ball of wax right away. They can just simply state what the head of the IAEA has said, and that is, we need to see the plans and the history and the development of this, since in violation of Code 3.1, you didn't disclose these. And I think we'll learn a lot early on about the Iranians' long-term view of these negotiations if they're willing, after some screaming and shouting, to come and hand those over. I think the sanctions that are at hand are ones that may at the UN level seem kind of light and a slap in the wrist, but I think you'll see what happened repeating itself from 2008, that the U.S. Treasury Department and the State Department are willing to go ahead with more tougher measures on Iranian banks, which can really complicate life in the Middle East for the Iranians.
So, Mark Lendler of the New York Times, what we have been hearing about that they're willing to go beyond a slap on the wrist in terms of the sanctions. What have we heard for the Obama administration on what kind of sanctions they're willing to pursue?
Well, I mean, the list of potential sanctions is pretty well known. It includes things like, as my colleague just said, cutting banking ties and making the cost of business for the Iranians more expensive. There's also possibly cutting insurance on shipments to Iran. There's cutting foreign investment, delivery of equipment to their oil and gas industry. So those are all sanctions that are fairly well understood, some of which have been tried in one form or another. There's a sort of a second, more stringent level of sanctions that you could contemplate, which would include trying to put an embargo or a block on shipments of refined fuel products to Iran.
Because they don't have a lot of good refining technology.
That's right. I mean, although they're a very big producer of crude oil, they actually import a lot of refined fuel. And if you were to embargo that, you could actually inflict some pain on the country very quickly. The problem with that one is that there's a lot of concern about inflicting pain on ordinary Iranians at a time when the country has already been through a political upheaval, and there's a sense that if you have a government that was only reelected with a great deal of controversy and there's a lot of questions of its credibility and legitimacy, you don't want to slap a sanction on the country that ends up driving the people back into the arms of that government. And so that's one of the reasons that you'll hear Europeans in particular, the French have been quite open about this, but even the British have reservations about going that route. So it's not to say that it would never happen, but it's not going to be first on the list. And most important, just to reemphasize the point that any sanctions are going to happen hand in hand with efforts to keep this dialogue going, because there's a sense that if you use sanctions simply as a punitive measure, if you're simply out to punish the government with sanctions, that's been proven in the case of Iran not to be very effective. So the goal here is to try to keep the dialogue process going. And there is some guarded optimism on the American side that because of this chaotic election, because of the disclosure of this new nuclear enrichment facility, that the Iranians are more on the defensive than they have been coming into talks for a long time, so that there may actually be a possibility to move this along in the way that didn't exist for some time.
Okay, John Lindbergh, one last question for you. Iran has said it is not willing to discuss its nuclear rights during this meeting. Are they talking about the right to enrich uranium, or are they talking about the right to build nuclear weapons?
They are talking about their right to be treated as an equal member of the international community. And at the bottom, as we said before, that from the Iranian point of view is what these talks are about. And if they're talking about one set of things, we only talk about another. I'm afraid the prospects of the negotiations, they're going to be very, very difficult.
Okay, John Limbert is the author of the new book, Negotiating with Iran, Wrestling with the Ghosts of History. He was a U.S. diplomat at the American Embassy in Tehran in 1979. George Lopez holds the Hesburgh Chair in Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame. And Mark Lendler is the diplomatic correspondent for our partners, the New York Times. We're asking you how you would open up difficult negotiations with someone that you've had a past history with. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Now, some quick takeouts on stories that we're following this week. We're going to go first to Todd Zwillick, the Takeaway's Washington correspondent. Well, Todd, Democrats introduced a climate change bill yesterday. Is this a tiny little issue, Bill, or is this some kind of big deal?
Oh, this is a tiny little issue. This is most of the economy. This is cap and trade and basically the entire energy sector. And
our lights, our taxes, everything else. So, yeah. So this is cap and trade. Cap and trade is back. This is the Senate version. You remember this debate from over the summer. It was huge and divisive in the House, and it's going to probably be even more so in the Senate. What this bill does at its core is cap carbon emissions at reduces them 20% by 2020. That's a little more ambitious than what the House got. They got 17% by 2020. That's taking all the carbon emitted from utility plants, cars, industry, and trying to bring it down by 2020 and then bringing it down even further by 2050. The Democrats on this bill only have Democrats so far. They're going to try to negotiate with moderate Republicans, but they don't have any yet. They had a big rally yesterday in front of the Capitol and made a big deal out of this bill. But so far, it's only Democrats. Here's one of the lead sponsors. This is John Kerry of Massachusetts.
There will be announcements in the forthcoming weeks about Republicans. I can promise you that. And I look forward to very constructive process that we've engaged in with a number of them.
Okay, he's engaged in it with a number of them, but not these Republicans. Listen to these ones.
It's going to raise the cost of every small business in our country and every family in our country. Your electricity rates, your gasoline per gallon costs are going to go up. This is not the time to be adding costs.
So that's Kay Bailey Hutchison of Oil Country, Texas, who incidentally is going to be leaving the Senate to run for governor, so expect her to be on the political side of this debate. You know, even more so than healthcare, this debate, Celeste, is going to be regional. You know, the soy states and the corn states versus the coast, the industrial states that don't want to lose jobs or coal production to the more sort of environmentally conscious states like California and Massachusetts. And when debates get regional in the Senate, they get very divisive. Getting Democrats on board could be as hard as getting some of the moderate Republicans that John Kerry says he wants to get.
Although the debate may have changed now that the Midwestern states have lost so many of those manufacturing jobs, I'm just wondering how they can possibly get traction on this with this healthcare debate going on.
Well, that's part of the question around the Senate. Timing is important. Nobody thinks they're going to get this done by Christmas. Don't forget, Copenhagen comes up in December. That's the Copenhagen Climate Conference. I haven't seen Copenhagen get this much attention, by the way, since those bad cartoons a couple of years ago.
Danny Kaye. Go ahead.
I mean, it's all about Denmark. So, but what they want is at least some forward momentum by the time of those talks. John Kerry, who is chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, says they don't have to have a bill passed by then, by early December. They just have to show that Obama is headed towards success on getting meaningful carbon caps for the other countries to come on board and think that the United States is finally serious about this issue.
Okay, thanks, Todd. Todd Zwillick, Takeaways Washington correspondent.
So now our next takeout comes from Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times, who is also down there in Washington. Good morning, Louise.
Morning, John.
So, Louise, poor Ken Lewis, right, of Bank of America, he decides that he wants to step down, to retire. It's been a tough road for Ken Lewis. Any idea why? Is this a spend more time with your family thing?
It has been a tough road, and apparently he was on vacation in August in Aspen. And when he came back to the bank in Charlotte, he came to work that first day with a beard, which he's a kind of buttoned-up guy. And so that really surprised people who had known him for decades. And it was on that trip, I'm told by people who know him well, it was on that trip that he started thinking of going on and retiring. He had said in the past he wanted to stay until the bank paid back the bailout money. And perhaps they will before he actually leaves. You know, he says he's going to retire at the end of December, but they certainly haven't gotten permission from regulators to do that yet. So he may not, you know, make that goal.
Well, Louise, listen with me as we go down memory lanes just for a bit to hear Ken Lewis talking during, it appears to be, much happier times on 60 Minutes last year.
It's said that one of the main reasons the bank is doing well is because of your decision not to get into subprime mortgages.
In 2001, my first year as CEO, we decided that we just didn't like the business. It was too risky, and so we decided to get out of it.
Seemed like a good decision back then, but Ken Lewis's story is like a lot of these bankers in the midst of this very public financial meltdown. They're seeing their lives pass before their eyes on television.
Yeah, I mean, that interview you just played from was last fall. I mean, as recently as last fall, he was really considered a hero.
A genius.
A genius, yeah. A hero, you know, and That's because Bank of America did appear to be in a much stronger position last fall than others, and they came in and bought Merrill Lynch as it hit trouble. And so a lot of people thought that that kind of rescued the market. So he was this hero. And remember, he really built this company from a regional player into a national bank. So he's done a huge, huge amount of work, and he's very ambitious here. But at the beginning of this year, it started to look like his ambition got the better of him.
Well, Louise, story
Merrill had been, you know, too ambitious.
Well, Louise, maybe the story is he caught some really amazing trout out there in Aspen and decided to just sort of cash it in. Ken Lewis. Maybe it was the fishing. Maybe he's retiring. Right. Ken Lewis of Bank of America will retire on January 1st as chief executive of that embattled bank. Thanks, Louise.
And our last takeout comes from our listeners. We got a huge response to the conversation we had yesterday about distracted driving.
See, my problem is, I really don't feel like stopping the car like every 5 seconds to answer a text message. My dad's like, oh, well, why don't you just pull over? It's a lot easier. You can just answer it then.
That's 19-year-old Alicia Jones, who you spoke to yesterday. Her father is actually a New Jersey state trooper. Well, Patricia wrote on our website, it made my blood boil to hear Alicia complain that she doesn't want to have to pull over every time a text message comes in. This bespeaks a level of self-importance so high that even personal safety, let alone the safety of others, must be sacrificed to keep up with the latest whatever. How about exercise? Some patience and maturity. And Steve posted on the comments page, those horrified by the attitude of the sergeant's daughter and obsessed by technology may be overlooking a more insidious cultural phenomenon. Whenever in a TV or film show a driver and a passenger happen to be conversing inside a car, the driver repeatedly turns to look at the passenger, thereby taking his or her eyes off the road. And Amanda from Joplin, Missouri suggests this possible solution. The best deterrent to texting while driving is peer pressure. Next time you suspect someone who texts you might be in the car, respond by mocking them mercilessly, then refusing to reply until they're out of the car. Disapproval from friends can be a serious motivator. That's why I stopped. And Bruce from Detroit, Michigan, had another idea.
I don't text while I'm driving, and I'm thinking, since all cell phones have a GPS chip in them, why don't they have a warning that pops up that tells you you're in a moving vehicle?
We have the technology. That could work.
Yeah. That's right. If you have a solution to this or any problem, keep them coming at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're also asking you, as these negotiations with Iran begin, how would you start a difficult negotiation with someone that you've had conflict with? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Coming up, we had a view from Indonesia after a second deadly quake struck last night. But right now, some of the top stories at 32 minutes past the hour. Fresh economic indicators just out a couple minutes ago. Weekly jobless claims are up by 17,000. They're hit 551,000. Investors were betting they would drop. Also out this morning, personal income is up very slightly and consumer spending is up 1.3%. An initial round of major nuclear talks between the U.S. and Iran is now over in Geneva. There may be another set of meetings between the U.S. and other world powers.
We're about to talk about Indonesia, but in the South Pacific, where American Samoa and nearby islands are recovering, they're getting medical and food aid. Officials say tens of thousands need help after this week's deadly tsunami. And President Obama is flying to Denmark tonight, joining his wife and the Chicago delegation to lobby for the 2016 Summer Games to go to the Windy City. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
In Indonesia, a second earthquake struck the country last night that follows yesterday's devastating quake that killed more than 500 people. Many of them were buried underneath collapsed buildings. Death toll is expected to climb. David Lang is a doctor with the medical charity Surfaid International, working in Padang in West Sumatra. He told our partner, the BBC, about the conditions there.
Most of the damage is in the main town center, and it's the multi-story buildings. It was about 5 o'clock, so lots of people were in those buildings at the time. It's going to be in the thousands of people that have been crushed or trapped.
We talked earlier today to the BBC's Karishma Vaswani in Padang, where that second quake hit. When we spoke, I asked where Padang was in relation to the earthquakes.
It's the nearest large city to the first earthquake, the one that struck on Wednesday at about 5 o'clock local time in the afternoon. Now, the death toll from that, as you say, is rising quite dramatically. In the last few hours, it's gone from about 400 to now above 500. What we're hearing is that the rescue officials are saying it's very difficult to get to some of the areas worst affected. In fact, Padang has most of the areas that are worst affected in the city. We've been here driving through trying to assess the damage for ourselves. Initially, on the outskirts of the capital city, it was very difficult to see what kind of impact this earthquake had had. But as you got closer to the city center, where homes are more densely packed, where buildings are closer to one another, the damage was evident. We saw scores of homes and buildings, hotels, restaurants, schools, completely collapsed. One restaurant, in fact, had been totally destroyed. And I was there while they were trying to pull, while rescue officials were trying to pull what they believe were 60 people still trapped underneath. Now, local people tell us that at the time the earthquake struck, the restaurant was packed. It's often frequented by college goers, young college goers who go there for a cup of coffee at the end of a long day. Now, the problem for rescue teams, of course, is trying to, it's race against time for them. They're trying to get as many people as they possibly can, but there's just not enough of them.
Well, I understand that the relief efforts are seriously hampered because not only are many phone lines down and communication is a problem, but many of the roads are impassable. They've been cracked, correct?
Yes, yeah, absolutely right. The phone lines have yet to be come up and running, although in the last couple of hours we've been able to get on the telephone. That wasn't the case when we first arrived in the city. Electricity is, again, not completely back up. So very big obstacles in the rescue operation. Road transport, road access, I should say, is also a challenge. Now, rescue officials have been saying to us that they've dispatched dozens of doctors, scores of doctors. This morning, in fact, we saw at least 90 get on one of the military planes that we accompanied to come and visit the city of Padang. Now, we're hearing reports, unconfirmed, that the Indonesian vice president is due to visit this city to try and assess the damage for himself and to try and figure out what kind of aid and rehabilitation package he needs to put together. Unconfirmed, I say, because we've got no official comments yet from the president's palace. But this is a very devastating disaster for the entire nation.
Okay. Karishma Vaswani is with our partner, the BBC. She spoke to us from Padang in Indonesia.
Joining us from Detroit now, Micheline Maynard, the senior business correspondent for the New York Times and author of The Selling of the American Economy. It's on sale later this month, from Random House. Mickey Maynard, good morning.
Hi, John.
So tough days when General Motors, after so many difficulties selling cars in the midst of a federal bailout, can't even sell a brand. GM announces it's going to shut down Saturn after Detroit businessman Roger Penske walked away from talks to buy the Saturn brand. It wasn't even cars they were talking about. What went wrong?
It looks like Roger Penske couldn't find someone that would build Saturns after General Motors stopped building them. The rumor is that they were talking to Renault and Nissan, the French-Japanese car makers, and that there looked like there was going to be a deal, and then that the board of the company just said, no, we don't want to do this. And it was quite a shock. I remember seeing the press release hit my email yesterday and just sort of gasping.
You know, Penske seemed to be most interested in developing a car company where you could almost customize your vehicle the way Dell used to allow you to customize, you know, laptop computers that you bought. It appears, though, that the actual factory implementation of this was a little more challenging than he had originally thought.
There are a lot of factors that go into this. You have to remember that Roger Penske distributes the smart car in the United States. So all those little smart cars you buy from a Penske Automotive-owned dealership. And what he had envisioned was taking the Saturn brand and starting with General Motors-built Saturns and then segueing over into somebody else-built Saturns. And the idea is that you wouldn't have to go to a car company anymore to get cars. You could just go to a car dealer, and then that dealer would supply you with products. But unfortunately, these things are very sticky, and it was difficult to negotiate.
I mean, maybe the legacy here is that Saturn is something of a jinx. I mean, it began as a bit of a innovative strategy for General Motors, cars made a fundamentally different way and marketed a fundamentally different way. Why didn't, in the end, that have much value for GM?
One of the problems with Saturn was that it made just a little bit of money at its peak, and then it really never made money as a standalone company. It seems easy. You know, this doesn't seem to be rocket science, but there are so many moving parts that go into running a car company. And one of them is simply making money on what you sell, and distribution costs are so high. Manufacturing costs can be high. I mean, the idea was that you would bring low-cost Saturns in from maybe overseas. But for Saturn itself, it really never got any legs. And then by the time it needed more investment, General Motors cut it off to support its other companies, its other brands.
And ultimately, while it may have begun looking different from other cars, in the end, the Saturns looked a lot like every other car on the road. It didn't distinguish itself so much. But I'm wondering, given its cult status, at least for a moment there, is there any chance the Saturns will turn out like, you know, the Studebaker Avanti or, you know, the DeLorean, these kind of coveted cars that people will meticulously keep in their garages and drive around the block once a year?
I think it helps if there are only a few thousand, and Saturn was selling, you know, about 250 to 300,000. So I think people will feel great affection and great nostalgia for Saturn, but as far as the cars themselves, they simply don't have that kind of collector cachets that an Avanti might have.
You need the cachet. Mickey Maynard is the senior business correspondent for the New York Times.
President Obama is meeting this week to talk about U.S. strategy in Afghanistan. And we're joined now by Zalmay Khalilzad, who was the U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan and then U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, both during the Bush administration. Good morning, Ambassador. You've said the Bush administration made some mistakes in dealing with President Hamid Karzai and that the Obama administration is continuing those mistakes. What mistakes are you talking about?
With regard to the Bush administration, three issues come to mind. One, that the level of Afghan armed forces was kept to a very low level. Two, there was not enough attention paid to the sanctuary for the insurgents and terrorists in Pakistan that came across from there and attacked in Afghanistan. And third, it didn't press Hamid Karzai hard enough to make progress on some of the issues that Afghanistan faced. In the case of the Obama administration, the neglect of the Pakistan sanctuary issue continues. In addition, they have indicated to Karzai that they would like to get rid of him. At least that's what Karzai believes. And that has resulted in a crisis of confidence between the United States and Karzai.
You've supported the increase in U.S. troops there. And I have to ask you, considering your background, you served the Reagan administration advising about the Soviet war in Afghanistan, and you helped guide the international program to promote the Mujahideen-led Afghanistan revolt to oust the Soviet occupation. And I'm wondering, do you see any parallels here between the Soviet occupation and the U.S. military troops that are now in Afghanistan?
No, it's very different in this case. The Soviet occupation was opposed very broadly in Afghanistan and around the world. And the Soviets thought to change Afghanistan into a Soviet satellite state. In the case of the United States, there is broad support in Afghanistan for what we are trying to do. This is not an occupation. We have a broad international support for what we're doing in Afghanistan. The difficulties here are one of strategy and tactics, not one of fundamental international and domestic Afghan opposition to what we're doing.
Ambassador, we spoke yesterday to Senator Saxby Chambliss. He's on the Senate Armed Services Committee, and he gave us a justification for why he thinks we need to put more troops on the ground in Afghanistan.
The problem with the Afghans is that we went in 8 years ago, we pulled out, we left them hanging dry, and they've got to have confidence that we're not going to do that again, because they know that if we do, then the Taliban leadership will make sure that those that supported Americans or NATO troops are killed or their family members are killed or whatever.
Do you think that the problems that we're having now are because we didn't finish the job 8 years ago?
It's in part that, but it's also largely that we haven't done some of the things that needed to be done for success. Success in Afghanistan is very important, not only in terms of terrorism, which is very important, but also in terms of the future of that region, which geopolitically is the most difficult at the present time. And I believe that the goal of helping regional stability, defeating terror, and preventing Afghanistan from becoming a sanctuary is important. What needs to be looked at is what changes in strategy and forces are needed to finish the job. And the key is, one, deal with the sanctuary, get a better relationship between Afghanistan and Pakistan, and two, build up Afghan forces, get Hamid Karzai, if he gets reelected, to do what he needs to do, and at the same time, perhaps increase our forces for the short term with a plan to draw it down as Afghan forces increase.
That's Zalmay Khalilzad. He's the former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan and the U.N. We asked him about rampant corruption in the Karzai government, and you can find out what he said about that on the website, thetakeaway.org. Stay with us to see how Google says they're reinventing email. Come coming up, Google wants to help break all your bad email habits. But first, we'll take a look at the top news stories at 47 minutes past the hour. We've got fresh economic indicators out just this hour. Weekly jobless claims are up. That surprised forecasters who were expecting a lower number. We're also learning consumer spending is up by the largest amount in nearly 8 years. This says personal income is holding relatively steady. The first round of major nuclear talks with Iran is now over. The U.S. was among several countries talking with the country's chief negotiator in Geneva.
Rescue workers in western Indonesia are searching the rubble for survivors of two powerful earthquakes. More than 500 are known dead. The American United Nations official fired from his post in Afghanistan is speaking out. Earlier, Peter Galbraith told us he's unhappy about being dismissed after raising major election fraud concerns.
This was a private disagreement between me and the head of the mission. It was a long-running policy dispute.
Our full conversation with Galbraith at thetakeaway.org. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
So the International Monetary Fund says the global recession is ending. They're predicting rosier days ahead with a 3.1% global growth rate. We talked earlier to the BBC's economics correspondent, Andrew Walker. I asked him why the IMF's predictions have gotten better since we talked about this in July.
Because financial market conditions have improved. Most obvious sign of that has obviously been the stock markets, but more widely, conditions in markets are a little easier than they were when the IMF was last looking at the question. Consumer confidence has shown some sign of improvement, and falling housing markets, again, have shown some signs of stabilizing. Worth remembering that economic forecasts are subject to quite large margins of error at the best of times, but I think the extraordinary conditions we've had over the last year with the big crisis in the financial system and the equally remarkable efforts to prop up the financial system are particularly difficult to incorporate in a kind of precise way into forecasts. So I think it's inevitable that the IMF was going to be moving its figures around. But this is a notable improvement. In the case of world growth, it's an improvement of 0.6% over what they were forecasting back in July. For the United States specifically, these are figures for next year, it's a slightly larger improvement, 0.7%. But it's still, you have to say, a fairly weak figure that they're forecasting overall.
Was it all good news coming from the IMF?
Well, not entirely. They've still got some real concerns about just how strong the recovery is going to be. They think it has started, but they're not convinced that it's going to be terribly well sustained. I mean, looking at the figures for the United States, for example, they're suggesting next year growth of 1.5%. Now, that, if that were right, that would suggest continuing increases in unemployment. And more generally, the US and elsewhere, they think there'll still be significant problems in the financial sector as banks try to repair their balance sheets, try to repair their finances. It's going to be difficult for them, perhaps impossible for them, to provide all the credits that is needed to support a decent economic recovery. And they also have some concerns about the global situation. China and others have been extremely dependent on exporting to the US for their growth in the past. They're not going to be able to do that so effectively in future. So they're going to have to think about a rather different future as well. And that might be a problem for countries like China.
Very quickly, how seriously do people take these assessments from the International Monetary Fund?
I don't think they take them as being absolutely reliable indications of what's coming. And frankly, I think in financial markets, they have their own views on what's coming. But nonetheless, it is an important indicator of what the outlook is in general terms. But don't get too hung up on, you know, the last percentage point.
That was Andrew Walker, economics correspondent for our partner, the BBC. We spoke to him earlier this morning about the IMF's new predictions on the global growth rate.
So our Thursday tech discussion begins on a very low-tech subject. Think about email for a second. Text only. I mean, there's really few forms of communication more primitive than email. It's kind of the equivalent of flashing cards from mountain to mountain. Low bandwidth. You can't really modify your statement in real time like a conversation. And Google, of course, the dominator of the world, is trying to reinvent email.
We asked ourselves the question, what might email look like if it was invented today? What you're going to see today, Google Wave, is our attempt.
That's Lars Rasmussen, Google Software Manager, unveiling Google Wave, a new tool from Google. And it is a way of sort of taking the bandwidth and the capabilities of the computer and infusing them into an email-like technology that actually might take advantage of the technology that we have in front of us, which we actually rarely do. Here to talk about Google Wave and actually the changes in search technology envisioned at Microsoft by the Bing search engine is Gina Trapani, editor of Life Hacker. She joins us from San Diego, California. Good morning, Gina.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And Sri Srinivasan is Columbia Digital Journalism Professor at Columbia University, is right here in the studio. Sri, good morning.
Nice to be here.
So let's talk about the bad habits of email, which really come from the very early days of computer technology, and the attempt that Google is making to update the way we use email, even though people for really almost a generation now have used the bad habits of email, and it's developed into something, a problem for attempting to bring new technology into communications like email.
I think when we're going to talk about the search part as well, there's going to be the same issue of inertia and habits that people have. And so what you're talking about is the habits of people who are using email, that they're used to using it in a certain way. This whole idea of Google Wave is that you can change real-time communications and make it a much more collaborative a way to talk to other people and share ideas. It's not something that's easy to explain on the radio in a couple of minutes.
But let's talk about it. I'm talking to you now here in the studio. I can see your eyes moving. I can see your face. There's body language in our communication. I can modify my sentence. I can say, oh, I didn't mean to say that, Sri. Or I can go, I'm sorry, that's wrong, without sending a separate command. And I can also, you know, show you pictures and things which are impossible on email. Google Wave is an attempt to simulate real conversations using technology that is already in the box.
And it's something that will take time, but once it happens, I think people are going to get used to this new way of kind of telling each other our stories and sharing a conversation.
Well, that's Google's bet, right? Gina Trapani, the world of high tech is littered with companies that made this same bet, and it didn't really pay off. It's one thing to modify the software inside a computer, but modifying the software of actual millions of users, that's something else again. Gina?
Yeah, it's quite an ambitious project. The Google Wave is quite an ambitious project, and in fact, it's not just a Google product. It's a whole new protocol for communication. It is really kind of a whole new reinvention of email, and it's completely open source, and any company can create a Wave client or a Wave server. It is not a Google-specific technology, it'll be very interesting to see what the uptake is.
Well, it directly confronts Facebook and other social media technologies, and the 1 hour and 20 minute long sort of tutorial on Google Wave has been downloaded 4.5 million times. They've invited 100,000 people to be first users of this. What do you make of the rollout strategy, Gina?
I think it's an excellent idea. I think it's a really great idea, because by bringing in just 100,000 users to begin with, Google can use those people to help test out the technology and make it better, and also create this incredible demand for the product. I mean, if you looked on Twitter or Facebook yesterday, I mean, people are just dying to get into Wave. They can't wait to see it. So it's an incredible marketing campaign, and it's also a smart, iterative software launch approach.
Well,
because they're getting people to help them make it better for free.
Having users do their R&D. Sri Srinivasan at Columbia University, let's talk for a second about the Bing search engine, which is a new iteration of search trying to compete directly with Google. Microsoft more quietly rolled that out. How is it doing?
Well, quietly, they still had a lot of ads on TV and everything else. I think that they're doing a lot better than many people expected at this point. They've had, I believe the numbers are about a little less than 10% of the market share.
And the idea with Bing is we're not just text searching, we're searching with visuals. We're actually using musical notes, even sound waves can be part of the search.
And what you're also doing is trying to find things in a much more real-time way than what you're used to with Google. But what's going to happen is, as I was saying earlier, the inertia factor. Are people going to try it in new places? What I do like is that They've also taken over the Facebook search. Once people, there are 300 million people on Facebook, the default search engine is now Bing there.
Wow. Sri Srinivasan, Columbia digital journalism professor, and Gina Trapani, editor of the website Lifehacker. We shall see if the humans can all learn new tricks, because that's really what Google and Microsoft are trying to get us all to do. Thanks to you both.
So touchy negotiations went on in Geneva this morning between the United States, Iran, and five other countries. 30 years of more than frosty silence, sometimes very angry silence, and nuclear ambitions on the table. That's a difficult conversation. And we're asking you, how do you open up these kind of difficult conversations? What do you do when there's years of bad blood behind you?
This is Ren, calling from Atlanta, Georgia. I think that all of our negotiators should put on a Lady Gaga poker face before sitting down at the table with the Iranians, and that's my take.
So in the healthcare reform debate, our search for the meaning of this thing called the public option led us to a hotel in Times Square, New York City.
What can I do for you?
Front desk, please.
One moment. Is Matthew, does your wish?
I understand you have guest rooms, right?
We have guest rooms, yes, we
do. And in those guest rooms, every single one's going to have a restroom, right? A bathroom, right?
Yes.
Right. And the private hotel patrons will buy a room and have private use of that restroom, right?
Yes.
Okay. Now, in your lobby of the W Hotel, do you have a public option?
Yes.
So people in the lobby can just use the restroom in the lobby, right?
Yes.
Now, does this public option interfere with the private option in your guest rooms?
I don't understand the question.
Does it compete with it? I mean, do people say, hey, why should I get a room with a private bathroom when I can just use this public option here in the lobby?
No.
So people never say that? So do you wonder why people in Washington say that the public option in the health care reform debate would get in the way of private insurance options?
Hold on one second.
She eventually hung up. Didn't want to get involved in politics, I suspect. But maybe we're on to something here.
I don't understand the question.
Wouldn't be the first time on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Thursday, October 1st. Hang up on us, America. I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, John. This hour, we're going to talk to the guy that was fired by the UN from his Afghanistan office. He has some very, very volatile accusations about election fraud in the country. We'll see what's behind that. We're also going to get the latest on the debate over whether or not to send more troops to Afghanistan and the untold story of the Clinton White House.
But let's get to the bottom of this public option business. Republican Congressman Charles Bustani serves Louisiana's 7th District 20 years. As a cardiovascular surgeon, doctor, congressman, weeks and weeks of speeches, arguments, and debates. Do you think Americans understand this public option business any better now?
Well, I think there still is a great deal of confusion out there, John. Although a large number of Americans have read the House bill, H.R. 3200, and seem to have a pretty good grasp of what this entails. But let me say that it's a pretty complicated issue because if you look at the public option, the government option, the way it's set up in the House bill,
right,
there are some real problems with the financing of it. It's set up largely on the same basis as what the Medicare program is set up on with regard to how it reimburses physicians and hospitals.
Whoa, we'll get into cost in just a minute. Congressman Bustani is going to stay with us. But first, everything else you need to know this morning.
In the headlines, the first round of nuclear talks with Iran is now over in Geneva. And in western Indonesia, rescue workers are searching for thousands trapped in the rubble after a second quake there today.
General Motors is shutting down the Saturn brand. A deal to sell it to Roger Penske fell through. And new numbers this morning show weekly jobless claims are up. And consumer spending is up as well, even though personal income stayed just about the same. It's moving the markets. Wall Street dipped just a bit yesterday. The Dow opens at 97.12 this morning. The S&P starts trading at 10.57. The NASDAQ at 21.22. Futures trading suggests a negative open when Washington gets underway. So difficult conversations. We do that all the time on this program.
Absolutely.
The Iranians and the Americans and five other nations are going to be meeting with Iran about its nuclear program. Difficult conversations. How do you begin a difficult conversation? Give us some advice from your life. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
Work.
Good morning, everyone. Boy, you could hear the agony of the health care reform debate again this week in the voices of lawmakers. Among the buzzwords this week, giving people choice. Here's Senators Charles Grassley, Jay Rockefeller, and John Kerry.
Giving people choice is very, very important, and this is going to kill choice.
Give people a choice. What is wrong with giving people a choice?
Freedom of choice, freedom of choice, freedom of choice are unwilling to allow a competitive entity that actually allows people real freedom of choice.
Freedom of choice. What you got?
There at the end, Devo, the senator from the state of 80s techno music, I guess. But what are the real choices for Americans being debated on Capitol Hill right now? Is it possible to know what the healthcare landscape for Americans is going to look like when reform, if reform, actually passes? We can at least get a wish list from three people who are both lawmakers and doctors. Yesterday, we heard from Democratic lawmakers with a healthcare background. Today, we've assembled a roundtable of Republicans. We're joined once again by Congressman Charles Bastani from Louisiana's 7th District, southwestern Louisiana. He has 20 years of experience, you'll recall, as a cardiovascular surgeon. Congressman Michael Burgess is on the line. He serves the 26th District of Texas. That covers the Fort Worth area. Before that, he practiced obstetrics and gynecology for over 20 years. And we're also joined by Senator John Barrasso of Wyoming. He's been an orthopedic surgeon for nearly 25 years. Let me begin with you, Senator Barrasso. It's possible even to say at this point, when Americans wake up the day after health reform passes, if it passes, what do you want the landscape to look like for, say, someone who's been putting off a procedure, who doesn't have insurance, who's scared they're going to get bankrupt if they even go into a doctor's office? What do you want that person to see the day after health reform passes?
I want them to see opportunity that they're not going to see, because this bill doesn't actually affect health care for 4 years. It doesn't start until after the next presidential election and the next inauguration. But the taxes start day one. So no, they're not going to see a thing for 4 years. And what I'd like to see is for people to be able to buy insurance across state lines. I'd like them to, if they buy their insurance individually, to get the same tax advantages that companies get. You know, I'd like to actually have a wellness program in place that would give that person an incentive to lose weight, get down their cholesterol, get down their blood sugar. I'd like to see that people in all of the areas of healthcare aren't worried about abusive lawsuits, which drives up the cost of care. And I'd like to see a lot of this waste and fraud and abuse removed from the system.
All
because
right, but
it
basically,
is rampant right now.
But the headline there is you want to see something done now as opposed to waiting 4 years. Let's get a read from Congressman Michael Burgess, again from the 26th District of Texas. What do you want to see for a person who has insurance and is pretty happy with their coverage the day after health reform passes, if it passes?
Well, clearly you'd want to see no change, wouldn't you? And I think Senator Barrasso is correct. There won't be any change in benefits for 4 years. That's what a lot of people are missing in this great debate. But fundamentally, most of us who are physicians want the doctor and the patient to be left alone in the treatment room, the patient to be able to take the doctor's advice or reject it. And as far as coverage is concerned, unfortunately, the argument does become a lot more about insurance than it does about medical care. But as far as the coverage is concerned, yeah, we want people to be able to, people who want coverage, we think ought to be able to get coverage. Big problem right now with people with pre-existing conditions and insurance rescissions. Let's fix that. That's insurance reform. That doesn't take $1 trillion. We could do that. We could do that without breaking a sweat and have it done in the next couple of weeks. It's telling that we won't fix the problems that the American people told us over August that they want fixed. They want pre-existing conditions fixed. They want the concept of being competition.
Right.
Yeah, Senator Kerry wants to give one other choice. We'd like to give 1,300 other choices to people who want a little competition and choice in their insurance market. And right now we prohibit that because of some of our arcane rules about selling insurance in certain markets.
All right,
we
Congressman Michael
things.
Burgess, let's hold on there for just a second. Let's get another word from Congressman Charles Bastani, who serves Louisiana's 7th District. That's southwestern Louisiana. Congressman Bastani, what is the landscape that you want changed for Americans who wake up the morning after health reform is passed, if it indeed is passed?
John, I want Americans to have a wide range of choices in insurance options and in a very transparent way. Americans like to shop. They want to be able to make real cost comparisons and have real choices. And if you have that, then you can drive the cost down. So I
don't
agree.
Don't we have that now?
No, we don't. No, it's very,
so how
very
would
segmented.
It change? How would it change?
Well, I think what you have to do is, first of all, open up the insurance marketplace across state lines, as Senator Barrasso mentioned. I think it's very important. It's an important first step. It's something that won't cost the American payer American taxpayer, you know, any more. It won't add to the deficit. Let's create real competition, real choice, and transparency. And also, what we want to do is make sure that the insurance that's out there really leads to a meaningful doctor-patient relationship, which is the real focal point for high-quality health care and the real focal point for keeping the cost down.
Congressman Burgess, I'm just wondering, you know, we're talking a lot about keeping costs down and giving people a place to shop and marketplaces for insurance, but how are we going to cover the uninsured and those who don't have the funds and the means to go shop for insurance?
There are any number of things that could be done right now without turning the entire system on its head. Fixing the problem with people who want insurance and yet find that they are priced out of the market because of a medical diagnosis they already have. Keeping people from losing insurance, which they have paid into over time, and then their insurance company drops them when they get a tough medical diagnosis. We could fix those problems right away. There are always going to be people in the country who resist the purchase of insurance.
Well, but
the unemployed?
We can make the conditions much more favorable by allowing policies to be sold that are within the economic reach of more individuals, and for people who are unemployed or who cannot afford an insurance policy, there are things we can do to stop punishing people in the tax code and make tax credits available to people for the purchase of
but
insurance.
But, Congressman, how do you do that without a subsidy or without actually just offering the insurance through the government?
Well, offering the insurance through the government is no solution because, let's be honest, if that were the solution, it would have fixed the problem. We already got 50% of health care expenditures right now coming through the government, and no one would pretend that there aren't problems with the public sector today. In fact, that is the problem of seeing the rest of the system alive right now. And the problems with administrative pricing that are brought to us by having a heavy hand of the federal government involved. These are things that again, was within the purview of the federal government to fix because we caused the problems in the first place.
Okay, Congressman Michael Burgess. Hold on one second. I just want to re-identify all of you here because you're all on phone lines here. Congressman Michael Burgess from the 26th District of Texas. Congressman Charles Bustani is from Louisiana's 7th District. And Senator John Barrasso is from Wyoming. All three Republicans, all three with a health care background. You know, we don't have a whole lot of time here, but it is a curious thing to me. How does your health care experience figure into the debate in Congress? I mean, I would think that all three of you as doctors are familiar with insurance companies intervening in the patient-doctor relationship. But Senator Barrasso?
Oh, absolutely. And I've been fighting both insurance companies and the government for 25 years, all in the interest of patients and patient care. And I took care of anybody that showed up as an orthopedic surgeon. But I have to tell you, I have town meetings all around Wyoming, and no matter who I talk to, people are concerned that, and especially people who depend on Medicare for their health care, they're rightly suspicious when they hear that this is going to be paid for with $500 billion in Medicare cuts.
All right, that's
so
the cost issue.
People believe they're going to end up paying more and getting worse care, and those are the national numbers, and people are very concerned they're going to pay more and get less. And
understood.
That's not an American value.
Understood. Michael Burgess, how does your health care experience help you or hinder you or disqualify you in the health care reform debate?
Well, just like Senator Barrasso, I mean, I took care of patients who came to me in every possible circumstance and certainly took care of my share of people who could not pay or had no hope of paying. At the same time, I also recognize that there are problems rampant within the private sector. Again, we could fix those problems if we just simply had the political will to do so. But expanding the federal role, the big problem, and I know you don't want to talk about cost, but we are cross-subsidizing the federal component of health care with the private
right,
sector.
Nope, understood.
You get a payer mix that's more than 50% Medicare and Medicaid in your practice, and it's going to be very, very difficult to keep the doors open.
All right,
we
heard
that testimony from practicing physicians in our committee last year.
Thank you, Michael Burgess. And Charles Bustani, I'll give you a last word here. How does your medical practice help or hinder you in this whole health care reform debate?
First of all, having practiced for 20 years, I understand how all this works at the ground level with a patient in the clinic or in the hospital. And that kind of perspective is very valuable because we understand what the unintended consequences are going to be with
right.
some of the things that are being proposed.
All right, Congressman, I got to get three quick answers from you. I hear three no votes if the vote was held today. Charles Bustani, Congressman, no vote on health reform?
No vote on the current bill.
Okay, fine. Congressman Michael Burgess, I hear a no vote. Is that...
We have no bill, sir.
All right.
The bill that I saw in committee, my vote was no in committee.
All right, John Barrasso?
They still have hundreds of amendments to work their way through, but as of this point, that's a no.
All right, John Barrasso, Senator of Wyoming, Congressman Michael Burgess, 26th District of Texas, Congressman Charles Bastani of Louisiana, all three Republicans, all three doctors, health care reform.
Now some quick takeouts on stories we're following this week. Let's go first to Todd Zwillick, the Takeaway's Washington correspondent. Todd, the Republicans and Democrats are battling on Capitol Hill, but not just about health care, right? They're fighting over Afghanistan.
They're fighting over Afghanistan. The administration is involved in meetings, talks with the national security team and the military team on where to go on Afghanistan. And the Hill, parts of the Hill, Celeste, are getting impatient. You know, the Republicans on the Hill think that General Stanley McChrystal, the commander of NATO forces in Afghanistan, agrees with them. More troops and do it fast. So they're trying to ratchet up the pressure on the president. There's a defense spending bill on the floor right now, and people on the Republican side want to get McChrystal on the Hill. John McCain is a leader on this, of course. He's a leader on military issues for the Republicans. He's on the Armed Services Committee. He's been very vocal. So listen to what McCain had to say yesterday.
Chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, the majority leader in the House, as and the rest of us all want General McChrystal to testify, and we hope it's sooner rather than later.
Okay, he's actually selling it kind of short there because McCain is putting an amendment on the floor this week on a big defense spending bill compelling McChrystal to come to the Hill and testify. And that's kind of rare. That's really trying to put pressure on the president. Of course, the chairman of the Armed Services Committee is the one who controls this. So listen to Carl Levin here.
I want Obama to have the same space that was given President Bush, who took 3 months to think through his decision before he announced the surge. And then his chairman of the Joint Chiefs testified, and then General Petraeus testified after the president made a decision. That's the right order. It's only fair.
A division in the Democratic ranks about where to go on Afghanistan, Celeste. More troops now or not. And there are a lot of powerful Democrats who don't want to have sort of a surge in Afghanistan. And they're trying to hold off the pressure, give the president a little bit of time to make his commander-in-chief decisions before the generals come on the Hill and start making very public statements about it. That's what this fight's about.
Okay, thanks, Todd Zwillick, Takeaway's Washington correspondent.
Our next takeout comes from Louise Story, finance reporter from our partner, The New York Times. A big story today. If you're someone who has a loan out, you probably have never heard of CIT. But if you're a business, you know all about the company CIT. And the small business lender may be headed for collapse. The U.S. has a $2.3 billion stake in CIT. Good morning, Louise. This is a huge story.
Good morning, John. It is big for small and medium-sized businesses. It's particularly big for retail. And, you know, retail's already having a difficult time with the economy. But it's also big for us as taxpayers because, you know, this could be the first big financial company that we have a stake in where our stake gets wiped out.
So if we're looking at our...
that would be kind of a failure.
Right. If we're looking at our taxpayer portfolio of all the things that we bought last year and early this year, the $2.3 billion stake in CIT, if CIT goes under, could just simply evaporate, right?
Right. If they file for bankruptcy, generally preferred shares, which is what taxpayers have, get wiped out. Now, they haven't said for sure that would happen. One thing this has really made me wonder is whether the government at all regrets putting this money in CIT, because we've seen them sort of back away from CIT after they gave the $2.3 billion last fall. Then CIT applied to another bailout program, which was where the government backed its debt. And the government didn't let CIT do that. And then in July, the government wouldn't give them a second bailout. So I've kind of been wondering if, you know, this $2.3 billion is something that they regret at all.
Well, you know, there is a Main Street issue here. I mean, with all the CIT, AIG, and all the acronyms floating around in this financial meltdown. I mean, if retailers can't finance their inventory, right, that's going to mean vacant storefronts around America if CIT actually goes under, correct?
And a lot of jobs. I mean, think how many people work in retail. Think how many people work in different restaurant chains, which also rely somewhat on CIT for financing. So it is kind of this middle market player that you've never heard of, but is very important to a lot of American businesses.
All right, Louise Story, thanks so much for that. Finance reporter for the New York Times with your takeout on CIT.
Now let's talk sports with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway sports contributor. Ibrahim, I'm happy to talk about baseball today. What happened?
So the weather is feeling like fall. It's October. The Red Sox were trounced last night 12-0 by Toronto. They're limping into the playoffs, and they know they're going to face the AL champion Angels of Anaheim. The Yankees' Jabba Chamberlain failed another pre-playoff test as they lost to the Royals 4-3, and they're patient wait to see who their competition is going to be, Detroit or the Twins. Last night, Detroit made that very clear. They won 7-2, and they can take a commanding lead. They could win the AL Central today, this afternoon, with a win. And they would be joining both the Phillies, who cruised an easy victory last night, 10-3 over Houston, who joined both the Cardinals and the Dodgers as the NL teams that know where they're going to be in the playoffs. The big performance last night, the big October performance, was a guy named Ricky Nolasco for the Florida Marlins, who faced off against the Atlanta Braves, and he literally struck out 9 batters in a row, which is one shy of Tom Seaver's record, which is like something like 40 years ago. That was the October performance last night.
So we're getting ready to clinch up the baseball races, but something else that's big happening in sports is the NHL season starts soon. What's going to happen in NHL?
So if you're not a fan of the NHL, just know this. The NHL is returning to a more finesse, skillful game. So you got guys like Sidney Crosby from the Pittsburgh Penguins, who last year won the Stanley Cup. He's known as the next one, like Gretzky was the great one.
The great one, yeah.
And then Alex Ovechkin of the Washington Capitals. He's the 2-time consecutive MVP. They're the best duo since Wayne Gretzky and Mario Lemieux. This season is going to be one of the longest seasons ever in the history of the NHL because it's going to be interrupted by the Olympics, which means that instead of an all-star game, you're going to have an all-star tournament. You're going to have all the best players in the world playing together in Vancouver. And it's funny for the Vancouver Canucks, they're going to have the longest NHL. They're going to have the longest road trip in NHL history, 14 straight games on the road. What I'm looking forward to also is the Winter Classic that's going to be at Fenway Park. Can you imagine that?
The outside hockey game, right?
Exactly.
Yeah,
the Winter Classic. In the shadow of the Green Monster, you're going to have the Boston Bruins take on the Philadelphia Flyers. And then another interesting stat here is only about 90 players, because of the statistics and how hard it is to win a Stanley Cup, only 90 players in the NHL are likely to win a Stanley Cup in their career. That's incredible.
Because there's a lot of players in the league. So you're saying that the league is kind of returning to more skill. That means we're not going to see as many gloves dropping on the ice. And
You will not see as many fights in the playoffs. So what you're going to see are people that are like, ooh, a little more squeamish, and they're going to want to play skillful, finesse hockey. And that's why people should pay attention to the
NHL.
In
business terms, that worked for the NHL last season. They did all right.
It definitely did. And all the other interesting thing is that you have a younger league, and that's what's going to be interesting. The Chicago Blackhawks, for example, they only have 5 players over 30. And they're one of the teams that people think is going to win the Stanley Cup this year. So it's going to be an exciting year.
Okay. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen is a Takeaways sports contributor. Thanks so much for coming, Ibrahim.
Good morning.
We will be watching the baseball
there's
race.
Your takeout. Yeah, coming up, the top American official working at the United Nations in Afghanistan has been fired. He's going to tell us what happened in just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, we'll talk to the former top American official at the United Nations in Afghanistan who has just been fired. We're going to find out why. But first, let's take a look at some key stories at 32 minutes after the hour. This hour, we're learning about an important new meeting between the U.S. and Iran. Top officials from both countries met one-on-one. It happened during a lunch break from those high-stakes nuclear talks in Geneva today between the U.S., France, Britain, other nations, and Iran. Western Indonesian rescuers are facing a huge operation following 2 strong earthquakes in 2 days. The death toll is already above 700. The government thinks that number will hit the thousands.
Also in Asia, they're bracing for more severe weather in the Philippines. Nearly 400 died in a recent typhoon there. Disaster officials are prepping for more dangerous flooding. And we've got fresh economic indicators just out this morning. Weekly jobless claims are up. That surprised forecasters who are expecting a lower number. We're also learning consumer spending is up by the largest amount in nearly 8 years. Wall Street's trading is down based on those numbers. Those are some of the news stories we're following this morning.
So we learned this yesterday from the United States. United Nations, the Secretary General has decided to recall M. Peter Galbraith from Afghanistan and to end his appointment at the Deputy Special Representative of the Secretary General for the UN Assistance Mission in Afghanistan. He expresses his thanks to Mr. Galbraith for his hard work and professional dedication. Peter Galbraith joins us now. He is the former UN envoy to Afghanistan. It occurs to me, Peter, that in the midst of Hamid Karzai attempting to be reelected, in the middle of a total strategy change going on between the U.S. and NATO in Afghanistan, that this is particularly oddly timed, your dismissal here. Good morning to you from Vermont.
Good morning, John. And setting aside the personal issues involved, I couldn't agree with that statement more. First, as a general matter, I think it sends a very odd signal to dismiss a senior UN official because he was concerned about fraud in a UN-supported and UN-funded election. But here we are in the critical week, 10-day period, as a rather controversial recount procedure is underway, and in an environment in which, frankly, the many Afghans, and certainly the Afghan opposition, has no confidence in the leader of the UN mission. They think, rightly, that he's biased toward the president. And they've seen me as the person who was pushing for a fair count and for making sure that all was done possible to deal with the fraud.
All right, Peter Galbraith, let's just focus on that very clearly. What evidence do you have that the reason you were dismissed was because you wanted to speak out about the evidence of fraud in the Karzai government and in this election? And secondly, the UN would say you just couldn't get along with your boss, Kai Aide.
Well, let me begin by saying that that I did not want to speak out publicly about the fraud, and I did not speak out publicly about the fraud. This was a private disagreement between me and the head of the mission. It was a long-running policy dispute about how to deal with it. Which, unfortunately, through no fault of either of us, became public when somebody leaked the fact that I had left Kabul to a British newspaper. Now, as to the evidence of this, I'd agreed with the United Nations that they would issue a statement yesterday, which stated the truth, which is that I had left or had been recalled. Because of a disagreement about electoral fraud. That was not the statement they issued.
Mm-hmm.
They then began to background this to suggest it was a personality dispute, which it was not. Incidentally, the head of the mission has been a friend of mine since 1994. We worked together in the Balkans when I was ambassador to Croatia, and he was a deputy to my counterpart, Thorvald Stoltenberg. We vacationed together on the Adriatic. He introduced me to my Norwegian wife. So we had a good personal relationship, but we had a profound disagreement about policy.
Well, let's talk about what the implications are for this disagreement. Why would the United Nations want to project that it was anything other than independent on the matter of the election campaign in Afghanistan, right in the middle of a conflict that's going on there? I mean, it seems to send the message that maybe Washington is pulling the strings at the United Nations. I don't know what it sends.
Well, first, I don't think this reflects President Obama's policy, and indeed the United States has been quite forward in wanting to have genuinely free and fair elections. And so, too, has the United Nations. The position that I took was really not mine. It was the position that represented the views of the entire professional staff of the United Nations mission that were working on the elections. There was no division in the United Nations mission on this. They were all taking the same view with me. The only exception was of the head, and of course the head is the one who gets to call the shots.
All right, then. Then the question becomes, and again, I'm just scratching my head, Peter, and we've talked before on all kinds of subjects, and I know your long experience in the diplomatic corps, but What kind of magic does Hamid Karzai have that he can, you know, survive despite all of these accusations, the problems he's had with warlords? He even ran with a warlord as his running mate in this election campaign.
Well, that is one of the questions that we don't know the answer to. But I want to say that the position that I took has nothing to do with whether Hamid Karzai or somebody else should be president of Afghanistan. It is much more basic, which is that the people of Afghanistan voted on the 20th of August. In parts of the country, they took considerable personal risk to go vote, and they deserve to have their votes counted honestly and the result not to be marred by the inclusion of well over a million fraudulent votes.
Is it possible, though, I have to ask this, that, perhaps you may have allowed your ego to get in the way of this issue of the people who voted in Afghanistan, and that someone who could have been an advocate is now out of the United Nations because of personnel issues that really sort of exploded in your face?
Well, I don't understand. How did my ego get in the way?
That you pushed this too far. You that if you were still there, you could actually have more of an impact.
John, in fact, my involvement on this was rather low key. I was hardly an activist. The final straw in this was a call that I made to the chief electoral officer when the so-called Independent Afghan Election Commission was about to make a decision to abandon the safeguards, which would exclude fraudulent ballots.
Well, we had to ask, Peter, but that's a great laying out of what's going on in Afghanistan. Peter Galbraith, now former UN envoy to Afghanistan, talking about the circumstances of his dismissal, which we learned yesterday in a statement from the United Nations.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And we used to call it Kremlinology, trying to figure out who was sitting near whom on the dais at the Politburo meetings in Moscow to figure out what was actually going on behind the scenes in Moscow. Well, it's a different sort of talent. And Steve Erlanger, Paris bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times, has that talent in spades, trying to decipher what's going on in Geneva as U.S. delegates meet with Iranian delegates and delegates from other nations in these high-stakes talks on nuclear policy in Iran. Steve Erlanger, we learned that there was actually a one-on-one meeting today between a U.S. official and an Iranian delegate. What do we make of it, and what are the circumstances insofar as you're able to determine?
Well, we don't know a lot of the details, but this was the chief American negotiator, who's the Undersecretary of State, Bill Burns, who met with Saeed Jalili, who's the chief Iranian negotiator. And the Americans had been hoping, I think, to have a kind of separate bilateral discussion. I don't know what they actually said, and no one has told us that other than confirming that it happened. But my guess is that there were some words spoken politely, as is Bill Burns' wont, but with a degree of force, telling Iran that its time was running out, that sanctions were coming unless there was a decent process of negotiation on Iran's nuclear intentions.
How much of this, I mean, how do you separate the extent to which something like this is a bone thrown to reporters to give us all something to talk about versus substantive bilateral discussions which might have a future?
We don't know that yet. I mean, I'm not sure they're particularly worried about us during the day. I mean, I think they're going to worry about what they say to us this evening. But, you know, there is little bits and pieces that are coming out of the meeting. For example, this morning was mostly devoted to speechifying. There was very little conversation. And then they broke for lunch. So, you know, the big speculation here is whether it will go on for another day. The Iranians have already said that they will talk about the previously secret facility in Qom that was revealed last week.
Right.
That they want to set up some kind of system for visits there by the International Atomic Energy Agency. But frankly, the United States and its partners in the Permanent Five, plus Germany, want more. They want to get Iran into a serious discussion of its nuclear program. They want them to suspend enrichment.
Right.
And the Americans want, you know, as Mr. Obama came into office promising, they want at least to hold out the prospect of a serious strategic dialogue with Iran on a whole range of issues,
does
which
that,
are not just nuclear.
Does that mean, Steve Erlanger, Paris bureau chief of the New York Times in Geneva, that full diplomatic relations with Iran might be on the table as a bargaining chip somewhere, somehow?
No, I think it's too early for that. But what is on the table is the possibility of a serious discussion with the United States and Iran on all kinds of issues, ranging from the Middle East to nukes.
Well, that's big news. Steve Erlanger, Paris bureau chief for our partner, the New York Times, will check in tomorrow after all the speechifying. He's in Geneva, Switzerland, covering those talks. And as we mentioned, one-on-one negotiations. There was a meeting today between the chief of the U.S. delegation and an Iranian delegate. What is it a sign of? Well, again, we need people like Steve Erlanger to have us sorted out.
In just a moment, we're going to speak with historian Taylor Branch about his years of secret conversations he had in the White House with President Clinton. But first, we're going to look at some of the top news stories we're following at 47 minutes past the hour. As we said before, the U.S. and Iran met one-on-one today in Geneva. The direct talks are the first known high-level nuclear discussions between the two countries. The meeting came during a lunch break from multinational nuclear talks with Iran. And rescuers in western Indonesia have enormous task ahead. They're trying to find thousands believed trapped in collapsed buildings. Two powerful earthquakes in 2 days have caused widespread damage. More than 700 are dead, and there are also reports of looting.
Disaster workers fear it could take weeks to find all the missing people in the South Pacific. A tsunami hit America's Samoa and other nearby islands earlier this week. And back in Washington on Capitol Hill, Senate Finance Committee Chair Max Baucus says he has the votes to get his health care bill out of committee. The Democrat says the bill could be finished by tomorrow. President Obama heads to Copenhagen tonight to support Chicago's bid for the 2016 Summer Olympics. The First Lady is already there campaigning. The official vote is tomorrow. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
So if you had a chance to have a private conversation with the President of the United States, what would you ask him? That was the question for Taylor Branch. He was granted a series of exclusive interviews with former President Bill Clinton while Clinton was in office. And Taylor's just now releasing his 700 or so page book, The Clinton Tapes, Wrestling History with the President. So how did this happen, Taylor? How did Clinton decide that he wanted you to come over in the evenings and record these interviews with him?
He initiated it before he even took office. He loves history. He was worried about the quality of the records that would be preserved, since he can't record his telephone calls anymore. Since after Nixon was impeached, no president has done that. And the quality of historical records has suffered. And he consulted me, an old friend who had worked a lot in presidential libraries, out of the blue, asked me, what can I do to make sure that the records 50 years from now will really reflect what's going on in the administration? And we lit upon this idea of doing a secret diary. He said he was going to train somebody else to do it on his staff so it would be more convenient, but he never did. So we did it all 8 years.
But he did start to get a little nervous about it. Supposedly he hid these tapes away in the back of his sock drawer.
Oh, he was nervous right from the beginning. He was terrified that if it got out that he was taping a secret diary, that a hue and cry would rise up, that the answers to everything were in there and that it would be destroyed or opened immediately.
Or subpoenaed.
So from the very beginning, it was secret. And only in the second administration did he trust me enough to say, you put them away. He had hid them in his sock drawer in the closet in the bedroom.
So what this book is really the view of those 8 years of events and even after his presidency, just through Clinton's eyes. And this is something that's from 1995, a press conference in Hyde Park with Clinton and Boris Yeltsin.
Well, now for the first time I can tell you that you're a disaster.
Be sure you get the right attribution there.
That is Bill Clinton laughing about Boris Yeltsin. So what the book really does is kind of gives us Clinton's inside view of some of these major historical figures, Pope John Paul II, Boris Yeltsin, and others.
Others, Yitzhak Rabin, King Hussein of Jordan, Bob Dole, Trent Lott. I was stunned to hear him. He was very collegial, even with his political opponents. He never begrudged them calling him names or anything. He was more disappointed in the press, that the press was fixated on tabloid scandals rather than things of great consequence for Americans. But yes, this is what he couldn't say in public and wanted to have on the record and was afraid he would forget.
He clearly was obsessed with politics. He loved to talk about politics. It didn't matter what party they were part of. He said that Bush was not all that, probably wouldn't be a great president, but was a really good campaigner, but that John McCain would probably be a good president, but was terrible in running. And here's something he had to say after the election in Florida.
Once again, the world has seen democracy in action. The events unfolding in Florida are not a sign of the division of our nation, but of the vitality of our debate.
So that's what he had to say publicly about what happened after the Florida recounts and all of those things going on. What did he say privately?
He said privately that it was a crisis and potentially a constitutional crisis for American democracy, and that he was afraid the Supreme Court would do any, if it got a chance to decide it, that it would politically do anything it could to decide the election in favor of Bush. He said a lot about the faults of the campaign and of his own performance and his own responsibility for that loss, too. And told me out of the blue that he had had a terrible two-hour confrontation
fight
with Al Gore over it and put it on the record. But typically, he described to me Gore's position and Gore's side of the argument almost as fully as his own side of the argument. He's pretty candid. And
describe to us this discussion that this actually turned into a real fight between the two men.
Who had a wonderful relationship all through the rest of the book. There are funny things and wonderful things happening with Gore, and he still respects Gore, said he was a great vice president. But Clinton thought that he could have swung a couple of the close states, specifically New Hampshire and Arkansas, among others, for Gore had he been used more, but that the Gore people were suspicious against him, saying the Clinton scandals were dragging him down. And Gore said that's what his people were telling him and that he resented Clinton for injuring his chances and also for not apologizing personally on the Monica Lewinsky matter. And Clinton went back to Gore saying, now that we're being honest, you know, I want to tell you that you've been kind of captured by Washington's obsession with that, and that Hillary had a lot more reason to resent Clinton over Monica Lewinsky than Gore did, but that she ran unabashedly in New York on the Clinton-Gore record and won, and that's what Gore should have done. And it was back and forth like that, pretty raw.
So, since you've brought up Monica Lewinsky, I have to...
Oh, that was dirty.
I have to ask you...
700-page book, pal.
All right, okay, that's fair.
I have to ask you, you and Bill Clinton were friends for years, and I have to wonder, you're going to see him very often, talking to him intimately, he's bouncing ideas off of you, and suddenly this Monica Lewinsky thing hits and grows and larger, and you say that he didn't really talk about it at first, but how did you feel? Did your feelings toward him change after the Monica Lewinsky scandal was made public?
Well, made public is the accusations came out. That was one thing. But then, when he confessed that it was true and that his denials had not been true, yes, that was a terrible sense of loss for lots of people, because we all felt that he had been doing his best to combat a sense of ingrained cynicism about what government could do. That was his mission. For 30 years, we've been saying government is bad. And that he was on the verge of proving a lot of that cynicism wrong. All the scandals and Travelgate and Whitewater and everything were all bogus. But then with this one thing, he rescued the cynicism that had been so corrosive against American politics, and and it enabled people to sidestep his whole record. So, yes, it was a terrible moment.
Taylor Branch, you are a historian of the First Order. And you've certainly strode the corridors of history, you know, in a huge way. I'm wondering how you can convince me that this relationship with Bill Clinton and these diaries, because Clinton's already written a memoir, he's gotten his side of the story out, is actual history versus another example of the Clinton charm crusade, him trying to convince you of his way of thinking as opposed to the history.
Well, I call this wrestling history, and this was in my view, undertook this as a service to try to get the fullest possible record for other people to decide what it means. I don't present this as a digested evaluation of this history. but it is a record that would otherwise not exist. And I was constantly debating on one part of this book is it's divided between Clinton's view and my role is to give you a little sense of what it's like to go into the White House, be with the president, and my own wrestling with what my role is here. Am I his friend? If he asks me for advice, do I stop being a historian and be a citizen?
Wow.
So that's what I mean by wrestling history. We were both wrestling history. My role as the one gathering it and his role as the one trying to make it. I warned him, though, that these are in the moment with no benefit of hindsight. If you start talking candidly, you can't necessarily guarantee you're going to make yourself look good because you don't know what positions are going to be foolish in the future.
Taylor Branch is author of The Clinton Tapes, Wrestling History with the President. You can read Chapter 1 of The Clinton Tapes at thetakeaway.org.
What would have been a difficult meeting seemed to have ended today with, no concerns in Geneva. It's between two parties that have barely had contact with one another over the last 30 years. U.S. and Iranian governments sat down with some other government delegates to talk about nukes. But how do you start a difficult conversation? What's the first thing you would say?
I say serve a lot of good drinks at that conference, and that should put everyone in a good mood.
Well, maybe that worked. The solution possibly is more atmospheric.
Hello, this is Martin White from Midwood in Brooklyn. How we should open the conversation with Iran. First, we should apologize to them for backing the Shah.
Well, apologies all around there in Geneva. How do you begin a difficult conversation? We're looking for your advice at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Subscribe to our podcast to go because we are always on. And you can actually hear three Republican senators who are also Republican lawmakers who are also doctors talk about health care.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. It's all there on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway. Thanks for listening to the Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.